divine economics works in such a way that the gift of faith, the more it's shared and given away, the more it actually grows. This gift of faith, you remember last week, that we received as a gift from your parents, maybe your grandparents or your teachers, you received that gift and that you made it your own and you hold on to it, that it also has to be passed on. And that when this gift of faith is passed on, when it's shared, it actually grows more. But if it's held on to as just this sort of, well, it's my private thing, you know? My Catholic faith, that's just my private thing, me and God. It's actually lost. Jesus, in proclaiming the kingdom of God, and in his preaching, he comes back again and again to these different themes, and he repeats the same theme often over and over again, in his parables especially. That in so many of his parables, they're like this trilogy. There are these three parts to them. There's the gift, the trial, and the return. And actually, many great, it's no surprise, sort of blockbuster movie series, they follow the same pattern because it's the pattern of redemption. There's this great gift that's entrusted to a people. Usually in Jesus' parables, it's a father and his sons, or it's a master and his servants. And the master gives to the servants this great and precious gift, and he entrusts it to them. And then the second thing that happens is the time of great trial. The master goes away, or he's taken away. And then the whole drama is, what will they do now in his absence? Now that he's not there, what are they going to do, especially with this gift that's been given to them? And the third part is the return, in which the master triumphantly, and having been long awaited, he comes back and he sets things right and he gives judgment. That in so many of Jesus' parables, these three things, which in his parables, like we hear today, they encompass within themselves all of salvation history. That if Jesus, preaching to his disciples and everything he does, is entrusting to him, to them, this great and priceless gift, all of that goes to the moment of the ascension, in which the master, Jesus, is now gone from our sight. And what age are we living in then? If that was the gift that was being given, it's the time of trial, in which the master isn't here to our physical sight. And so what are we going to do with what he's given to us? And it's this time between the ascension and the second coming of Jesus, in which he will return. In this parable, people can focus a lot on the talents, right? And they'll talk about the talents maybe as like the talents we've been given. They're this large amount of money. A talent, biblical scholars say, is worth like 15 to 20 years of average wage. And so it's this huge amount. That's the point. But it's the pricelessness of it, that it's like the pearl of great price, that he's left them this immense wealth. And what Jesus has left is the gift of faith. He's left this whole deposit of faith and this whole deposit of moral teaching and this life of grace to his church. That this is what he's left. And you see this parable told as well in the Gospel of Luke. Each one has different details which are very rich. And one of them that the Gospel of Luke brings out is that this master, when he goes away, he's going to claim his kingship and his authority in this faraway land. And that you also hear Luke in his gospel, he says that when this king goes off, he's followed by his enemies who are set to destroy him. That they're wanting to do everything they can to keep him from taking his kingship. And so this is where the whole drama plays out, because this great wealth is given, and they're told that they're now to take it and to invest it so that it might grow, it might be fruitful. They're given this wealth, and they're told to build up the kingdom of God with it, to build up this king's whole kingdom in his name. But here's the problem. Here's where the great danger comes in. Right now, that land is held by a different person claiming to be king. Because there's two kings in this story. There's the king of this world. And the king of this world is the one in which these followers are asked to build up this kingdom within. And what does that look like? Because you hear like the kingdom of God spoken of all the time. What does it look like to build that up? The kingdom of God is the salvation of Jesus that you received. That you've been saved from death. And that you receive that. And that becomes something that I desperately want to give to others. So that they can receive that in their own heart. The salvation of Jesus. And that becomes something that they live out in their own life. And this creates and builds up the whole kingdom of God. And while Jesus, before his second coming, this is what he's entrusted to his church to build. Even in a domain, this world, that is under a different power. The one who is the king of this world. And so there's a way in which these servants who are being given this gift, they're being asked to stick out their neck. Because if that king doesn't return, what do you think is going to happen to them who have been building up commerce and investing in all these things in other people and doing everything with the authority of the name of the rightful king? If he doesn't come back, what are the enemies of him going to do? And so you can see where the one servant who just received the one talent, he looks at that and he's like, no, it's not worth the risk. It's not worth the risk. And so he buries it. The master comes back, he just digs it up and gives it back to him. But it's the other two who live out of faith and trust in the return of the king. England is not a place that is friendly to Christianity at all. If you want to find out more, you can just Google Baby Indy and see stuff from the last couple weeks, but that's just one small example. It is not a place that's friendly to Christianity anymore at all. So I studied there in grad school, and it was studying there that my faith grew, ironically, more than any other time in my life. Because I was in a grad program with 50 other students. And very quickly, it became clear that, oh, he's this Catholic who's like actually practicing his faith. We would go with this program on the weekends, because all week it was intense classes and stuff. And the weekends, for the first month, you went on a field trip all Saturday into the night. You got back late. And then a lot of the Sundays, you go on a field trip as well. And so I asked him, I said, well, I got to go to Mass on Sunday. And the guy who was running the program is very good. He's like, oh, we'll just take off an hour later. And so, you know, everybody goes. Not everybody. There's a handful who came and stuff. They're like, oh, these are beautiful churches. You know, I'll come with you. Most people just went and they had mimosas in the morning and a big brunch. So you get on the bus and you're driving to, like, you know, wherever, Gloucester Castle or wherever we were going. And, you know, it became very clear early on that this faith that I had received from my parents, and that at some point in college, I decided I was going to make my own and I was going to hold on to, that this faith, either I was going to bury it or I was going to have to share it and explain the faith and risk it, knowing that I don't know how to explain these things perfectly. To share the faith, to explain it, to defend it, when all sorts of things came up which are attacking the faith. Okay, am I going to bury my faith? Or am I going to speak up, put my neck out on the line? This is what these servants are facing. And so the one who decides, I'm not putting my neck out, he buries it. And what happens is when that faith is shared, it grows, it multiplies, it becomes fruitful. When it's not, it's lost. We're at the end of the liturgical year next week. And so next week, we close the liturgical year with the Feast of Christ the King in this month of November, in which the church is continually repeating the same thing. Memento mori, remember that you will die. Remember that the end is near. And so it's celebrating this Feast of Christ the King next week, in which we celebrate the return of the King. And so this week, everything is to be ready for his return. Jesus, we know in our faith that he is with us, right? We know this, but we know he's with us in the Eucharist. And he's with us in his church. But tell me this. Without faith, are you able to see Jesus present in the Eucharist? Without faith, are you able to see Jesus alive and present in his church? No. And so this is what he has given to his servants, to live that faith out. And next week it's a celebration of Christ the King, in which Jesus, he has promised, he will come again. He will return, coming into this land with all of his kingly authority. And when Jesus comes again and he appears, every knee shall bow on heaven, on earth, and under the earth. Why? Because it bows in this true sense of fear of the Lord, in the awe and majesty of them, of him. And he will ask, what have you done with what I've given to you? What have you done with it? Have you buried it? Or have you taken it? And yes, living in faith, knowing that there's a risk to it, taken and shared and defended your faith, that it might be fruitful, that it might grow. And those who have been faithful, notice that's what Jesus, that's what the master praises in the parable. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in small matters. That's what he praises above even any success. Come and share in the Father's joy. That there's one of two ways we can live. We can live with a fear of the world, a real fear of the world, in which we're afraid of the world's judgment upon us. What will the world think? What will people think of me? And we live in a way in which we then want to please the world. This is serving the king of this world. Or we can live with a true sense of fear of the Lord, in which our fear is that of the Lord's judgment, of not doing anything with what he's given us. And so we live in such a way that we seek to please the Lord alone with our lives. Not worrying about the world and its judgment, but the true king who will return. I want to close just by returning very briefly to this first reading that we had from Proverbs. Because the Lord, when he returns to those who have been faithful, that fear of the Lord is quickly transformed into a joy. Remember the master, come, share in my joy. Come and share in my joy. This reading from Proverbs we have, you hear it at weddings. I'm sure if you've been to a number of weddings, you've heard it. And it's praising the great virtues of a good wife, which is wonderful and it's true. But there's also something much deeper going on here, much more significant, that the Proverbs, the Lord is speaking here of his bride, the church, which is all of us, those who have been entrusted with this great gift. And to hear it reread, part of it now, in light of that, that it's us, the church, that are meant to live in this certain way. The good wife, a worthy wife. Her husband, Jesus, entrusting his heart to her, has an unfailing prize. She, all of us, the church, brings him good and not evil all the days of her life, having received this gift of the heart of the husband. The wife, which is us, does good with that all the days of our life, working with loving hands. She, the church, reaches out her hands to the poor and extends her arms to the needy. The woman, the church, who fears the Lord is to be praised, for she will receive a reward for her labors. That when the Lord comes again, and he will, that we'll hear, come, you who have been faithful and have helped build up my kingdom, come and share in my heavenly joy.